News, I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we present the fourth in our series of programs containing excerpts taken from the conference on Our Country, Our Culture, held this past spring at Boston University and sponsored by the Partisan Review. We'll first hear from painter and sculptor Jules Olitski, followed by educator and drama critic Robert Brustein. Jules Olitski is considered a central figure in the development of color field and abstract painting. In a career that spans five decades, he's earned virtually every accolade possible. And his work hangs in scores of museums, including Boston's Museum of Fine Art, the Whitney, New York's Metropolitan Museum, and the Museum of Modern Art as well. In addition, Olitski has had more than 150 one-man shows. Robert Brustein is best known as the head of Harvard's Loeb Drama Center and director of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. Prior to that, Brustein headed the Yale Drama School for many years. He is also a critic and a playwright. First, here is visual artist Jules Olitski.
About barley soup and art, high and low. I came upon this introduction browsing in John Ruskin's, I think, The Mount of Olives. And he was giving a talk, and I love the introduction to the talk, so I'm going to use it. He says, "My friends, I have not come among you to endeavor to give you an entertaining lecture, but to tell you a few plain facts." And to ask you some plain but necessary questions. I thought that was pretty good. All I was going to say was hi. Now, my talk has mostly to do, in fact, entirely to do with quality. It is under attack. Long before I could spell the word, I experienced it in a rather homespun way, literally so, with barley soup. My mother fed me, when I was a child, a boy, a man, barley soup. I've had it in restaurants in Coney Island, in Flatbush, Brooklyn, in New York's Lower East Side, in Patchogue, an exotic place, in Paris, London, Madrid. I like barley soup. I'm a connoisseur of barley soup. Curiously, one of the best of that soup I had at the old Horn and Hardart cafeteria, long gone, but it was terrific, 10 cents. The pleasure I got and the pleasure I get from barley soup, which serves the appetite, is of a different nature, of course, than aesthetic pleasure, which serves the spirit. Taste is the only path to quality, to aesthetic pleasure in art, music, poetry, and literature. As taste develops, so does one's pleasure, one's aesthetic pleasure. Pleasure doesn't make you taller, better, skinnier, richer. I wish it made me skinnier. Doesn't make you more of anything. It simply gives you pleasure. Nicholas Poussin said, "The goal of art is delight. It grabs you, it takes you. It takes you out of yourself, out of time. It's a unique experience. It is what one may experience, say, looking at a Rembrandt self-portrait, hearing Handel's Xerxes, let's say, reading Wordsworth's Home at Grasmere, which I think is just a wonderful piece of work. I remember coming all of a sudden upon Vermeer's view of Delft. And I was walking towards it. I must have been about 20 feet or more away. And I saw this painting. I didn't even know it was a Vermeer. It was a view of Delft. One doesn't swoon anymore since the 19th century. But I, like a maiden, I swooned. I almost fell to the floor. I thought then, and I think I may still think, that it was the most beautiful painting I've ever seen or that was ever made. It is evident that quality, the very quest for quality, is under siege. The word beautiful is considered something for the wealthy, the elite, who can afford the leisure to develop taste. Hence it is capitalistic, imperialistic, elitist, and one risks being called a fascist for seeking excellence and having pleasure in the beautiful. It simply isn't democratic. It attacks modern perception of equality, diversity, multiculturalism, and God knows what else. We are all, they tell us, we all must be in the same box. And I said this yesterday in response to something. Does anyone really look? I owe this to my wife, who says this frequently, to me and to everyone else. Does anyone really look in the yellow pages for a brain surgeon? Come on. I come now to the question of what happened to the arts, which is our topic of this panel. Thanks to a commingling of conceptualists, deconstructionists, feminists, and the scourge of political correctness, the Philistines, as Arlene Crocher once said rather famously, the Philistines have now become the artists. All that formerly was unacceptable is now celebrated. Some examples. Some of this was stolen from me by one of the speakers yesterday. Who was it, Christina? That went on about Ophelia and those guys. Anyway. Was it? Anyway, okay. Some examples. Gilbert and George, a playful British couple, exhibited photographs of 2 months, was it three, I don't remember, of their feces. Wait, it gets worse. The event was celebrated at the prestigious Royal Academy of London. Impatient crowds encircled the Academy, not to tear the place down, but to get inside and see what Gilbert and George had come out with. Abominations are the order of the day. Like the Roman circuses of old, the public must be fed its daily outrage. Daniel Kunitz, in a recent art review in the New Criterion, wrote, quote, "Of course, we now know that with notable exceptions," I wish he'd named them, "the artistic mindset of the latter half of the 20th century was dominated not by Greenberg, Clement Greenberg, but by Duchamp, Marcel Duchamp. Greenberg is out because more than anything, he stood for quality in art and had the temerity to point and say, this painting is better than that one. Marcel Duchamp is at one and the same time the Che of postmodernism and its Bouguereau, Bouguereau, the celebrated and fashionable French painter, in the Paris of the latter half of the 19th century. Duchamp came to the public's attention at the famous Armory Show, where he exhibited a sculpture, a urinal, signed R. Mutt, which pointed the way later, in more recent years, to Andres Serrano's Piss Christ, which is a photograph of a crucifix in a bottle of the artist's own special urine. Andy Warhol had already been celebrated for inventing what he called his piss paintings. I need not describe the technique. At least Bouguereau had some talent for painting. Granted, Duchamp's urinal could rightly be termed a sculpture. It had volume, one could traverse it, but is it a good sculpture by any aesthetic measure? No, of course not. It's low art, which was precisely Duchamp's point. It's anti-art, meant to sneer at taste, high art at aesthetic quality. Anton Chekhov, a dear man who couldn't write a sentence that didn't lift one's spirit, said, "We all came out of Gogol's Overcoat," Gogol's masterpiece of a short story. The abominations of postmodernist art, seems to me, come out of Duchamp's urinal. Soon enough, the taste for excrement was bound to follow and to be celebrated in its turn. I am told that 30 years ago, it may have been more recent, an Italian artist, I believe it was, packaged his feces and apparently tried to sell it. I can't imagine who would buy. But I'm going to use the Yiddish word dreck. And he sold it by the pound with a label, artist shit. One wonders how it was packaged if it was 30 years ago. There was a Ziploc. I don't know. New York for a time, the center of so-called advanced art, and it was, has given way to London, which is now the center for low art. And that is our good fortune. Tony Blair, Prime Minister, celebrates the antics of such artists as Damien Hirst and Chris I'm not sure how one pronounces it, Ophili, stars of the Sensation Show at the Brooklyn Museum. Mr. Hirst arrived on the art scene with half a carcass of a cow awash in formaldehyde. Mr. Ophili, a more serious, I believe, more talented British artist than Mr. Hirst, and then who isn't, does actually paint pictures. He actually on canvas. But again, his success is not based on his talent for painting, but for his liberal use of elephant dung. Elephant dung. Surely gorillas await their turn. The art draws attention, their art, for reasons having little or nothing to do with art. Yet it pretends to be avant-garde. The reality of it is it's academic art, easy to get, its style over substance. Philippe de Montebello, director of the Metropolitan Museum, coming away from the Sensation Show, observed in the New York Times in an op-ed piece, "The emperor has no clothes." and for that was reviled by many of his peers, who simplistically, apparently, believe no matter how lacking in quality, if it's new, it must be good, even great. I really don't have the heart to give examples. How demoralized, are art lovers that they can look at Dreck presented as art and not say, good God, this is really shit. Suddenly everything, no matter how inane, insane, obscene, or just plain silly, became interesting. A young British art dealer describes to me his excitement upon seeing Damien Hirst's Half a Cow. He asks me, what do I think? I tell him I've not actually seen the cow, except in reproduction. Yes, but what do you think, he asks. I say, it looks like something you'd see maybe in the National Enquirer. But I say, you saw the work. Did it give you a lift? Did it move you to delight? Well, not really, he says. But Half a Cow in formaldehyde, so surprising, so interesting, don't you think, as an idea? The idea, I say, about Half a Cow, now that is interesting. Our conversation, of course, languished. Now, interesting as an idea. At least Christo's wrappings try, pitifully try, to evoke the beautiful. At least he makes a gesture of sorts in the direction of aesthetic experience, though to my eye, not nearly enough. No. The Brits have learned from their American predecessors, Robert Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, for example. There is in their work, it strikes me at least, the initial surprise. Oddly similar to what one gets suddenly seeing a nude mannequin in a department store window. At first glance, it appears alive. And the more alive it appears, the more dead it suddenly becomes. And we turn away, somewhat embarrassed, hoping no one noticed. We feel we ought not to have looked. We feel we were taken in. All window dressing has that intent, as does John's American flag or Rauschenberg's goat, stuffed goat. Or was it a deer, antlers deer?
It was a goat.
I forget.
A goat.
It was just a goat. Well, it was enough. Feminist art is very much a part of the scene, current scene. Feminist art is often a matter of words, just a word repeated forever on a gallery wall or a museum, or more than one room in a museum. A word. Favorite words are peace and fuck. Frequently the focus is on genitalia, their own. Watching TV the other night, I was able to gather examples of the actual of feminist art, word art, I call it, by some of the masters of the genre. Here, for example, quote, what urge will serve us now that sex won't? End of quote. Which I suppose must be profound. Men don't protect you anymore. Another quote. The one I liked best I shop, therefore I am. I have the feeling I've left out something about feminist art, and yes, it came to me. Menstrual art. It's getting big. If the goal of art, as Nicolas Poussin said, is delight, what motivates the art that presently prevails? I suppose a hatred for our traditions, for the institutions which support our democracy, a hatred for excellence in itself. I sense a reflexive self-hate as well. Tenured intellectuals in our top colleges and universities, once radical students of the 60s, breaking windows in the institutions they attended to let the air in, as they said, with their, I remember their grinning impishly, with little boys having fun, now attack common sense and common sensical reality with language opaque, incomprehensible, enough to make the members of the Flat Earth Society appear almost sensible. Read, for example, Jacques Derrida on the art of painting. Oui. I believe art is expressive, in some sense, some real sense, of the reality of its time. It presents, if present abominations prevail, we are in trouble. I'm reading the same damn sentence over and over. I'm wrong. I believe, as I said, art is expressive of the reality of its time and present abominations and so on. I am told an artist is at present is exhibiting corpses which he drains of their fluids. Thanks. And injects with some kind of plastic material, flesh hangs draped over their bones. A fetus is visible inside the woman's belly. Even Dante would have averted his eyes and turned away. But not so the New York Times, which showed the photograph. I look at the cave art of Lascaux, 15,000 years old, more or less, 1,000 here or there, what difference, and Chauvet, supposedly 30,000 years ago, and other caves recently explored. Here, thousands upon thousands of years is art, elegant, beautiful, sophisticated, Degas, the guy who could really draw, would have been impressed. And Matisse, a master of color, he would have fainted. He did tend to faint at times. In front of a canvas, he would tremble. The tension of the art, the cave art, throbs alive with felt experience, with danger, darkness. It is art of quality, high, high art. I look at early medieval art, its expressive reality. Nothing moves. Change is incomprehensible. God is above. The sun revolves around the earth. The art has its own particular stillness, as does all high art. Then comes Copernicus and Galileo and mathematics and perspective, the Renaissance. Everything moves. Everything moves. It's a different world. Thrust and counter-thrust. Renaissance art is almost besotted, through and through, with contrapposto. Titian's last, for me, well, Titian did two entombments of Jesus. One, the later one, I think was the best, but some authorities, well, they disagree with me, so. It's one of the highest moments, I think, of the Renaissance. And so, too, the same thing happens in the art of the 18th and 19th centuries. They're replete. They are replete with their own expressive realities, their own great masters. The next, for me, it seems, the next major shift reality in this sense I'm talking about is expressed in visual art is Impressionism, perceived at least technically as a kind of diffusion. In the hand of a genius like Monet, diffusion becomes ravishing. It is left to Picasso and Braque's analytical cubism to present reality in fractured planes seen from many points of view. These expressions of what I'm calling an era's reality do not in any manner or form guarantee high art. High art is made by artists who make high art. Let me see if I can get to this next page. Throughout the ages, and most particularly, I think, in Hellenic art, beauty and excellence were premier goals until now when, like Gresham's law, the question is, will low art drive out high art? For the present, it seems to. Low art attracts more low. And maybe there is no bottom to low. For my part, I won't accept that, nor should anyone else accept the situation I've described with Damien and Mr. Ophelia's, and there are others, a lot more others, many more others, as irreparable. First great art is being made, created in the shadows, for the most part, unseen. Some are young. For me, at 80, young is 60. Darby Bannard is an example. For a long time, almost forgotten, suddenly emerges. I've seen some of his recent paintings. Making paintings overflowing with painterly feeling and ravishingly beautiful. James Walsh, another kid in his 50s, is also making, to my eye, wonderful paintings. There are others, highly gifted. Daryl Uto, Susan Roth, Bannard's one really young protege. I think he must be 30 or so, a baby. George Bethay, and not to leave out Walsh's wife, Annie, very talented. There are others. I sense there are, but I tend myself to stay close to my own studio and bath and bed and home and wife, all those good things. I wonder what effect, if any, I have gotten lost here. Oh, yes. It's many months now since September 11th. And I wonder what effect, if any, that day has had on the art community. Historically, the barbarians appear when they smell decadence. Are we in trouble? The smell indeed is ripe. It was about a week before the 11th of September that I received a letter from a dear friend, a sculptor. He was working on a group of sculptures to be called the Barbarians. He was excited by the work, and his description of it over the phone excited me as well. He had been reading some history, as he put it, of the barbarians, as he described it, of Huns swooping down from the mountains, raping and pillaging decadent Rome. Awful, he said, but they were rather welcomed, weren't they? I thought of my friend's remark when September 11 came, and in the days and weeks and months after. If our art scene reflects our reality, this art scene I've been describing, we're in bad shape. Are there enough Americans with enough common sense to not give a hoot about the academics and the theories and all the art world crap to prevail? I pray there are. Thank you.
Internationally known visual artist Jules Olitski. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to excerpts from the conference on Our Country, Our Culture, the Changing Role of Intellectuals, Artists, and Scientists in America, 1952 to 2002, sponsored by the Partisan Review. Tonight's topic is What Has Happened to the Arts? Next, we hear a lecture from drama critic and educator Robert Brustein.
My talk in your program is entitled The Three Horsemen of the Anti-Culture. Since then, I've added another horseman. So it's now the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, the cultural apocalypse. Recently, we were told that an ice shelf the size of Delaware broke off from mainland Antarctica and floated out to sea. That seems like a metaphor for the fate of serious culture in this country. We are witnessing the not-so-gradual disappearance of what used to pass for American high art, whether we are talking about the performing arts or serious literature or classical music or the visual arts. Typical is the fate of National Public Radio, which recently announced a total restructuring of its cultural vision aimed at increased coverage of popular culture. As the New York Times reports it, NPR is following public radio stations everywhere that are rethinking their cultural programming in response to audience surveys showing that classical music drives away listeners who prefer talk shows and news. The fact that NPR, along with PBS, which long ago succumbed to middlebrow taste and masterpiece theater, should even conduct audience surveys in order to determine cultural policy shows how completely public broadcasting has been swallowed up by commercial values. It is not the only example. With the spread of corporate capitalism and the gobbling up of smaller arts firms by huge conglomerates, money motives, once at least competitive with questions of quality, have begun to dominate all the markets driving our culture. Just as Walmart's is now monopolizing the book business and Time Warner the publishing industry, so the Disney block, having bought up most of 42nd Street, has begun to dictate the direction of New York theater production. Not that Disney is the only corporate giant in the mix. A conglomerate named Clear Channel, and I'm not sure how many of you ever heard of this, but Clear Channel not only controls 1,200 radio stations and 19 television outlets and 730,000 outdoor displays at present, but having acquired another entertainment giant called SFX, now owns and leases 135 theatrical venues in 31 cities, virtually monopolizing concerts, Broadway shows, and sports events in all these areas. There is a computer game called Pac-Man that's always struck me as a perfect image of what's going on. It shows a large mouth moving around the screen, voraciously ingesting everything in its path. A pretty fair description of what's going on in our culture. When ruled entirely by profit, the quality of art is bound to decline, and so is any openness to risk or adventure. The days are over, I think, when publishers took chances on good writers who were unknown or difficult in order to bring distinction to a list dominated by bestsellers, or when theater producers searched out the exciting new playwright to balance out a season of tired favorites like Our Town. But in addition to the eternal financial issues, there are certain ideological pressures affecting the quality and influencing the direction of the arts. In the old days, these evils could safely be assigned to capitalism, and the problem could be defined as Marxian, the fact that those who create the arts are alienated from the means of production and distribution. But today, the problem can no longer be attributed to or solved by a single political equation or system. They are colored by the conservative, radical, and liberal hues of the political spectrum alike. To change my metaphor, the arts are under siege from three horsemen of what may eventually be seen as a cultural apocalypse. Vigilante night riders who guard the right, left, and middle walls of the American castle, looking for a deviant artist. From the right gallops the horse of moral correctness, determined to purify the arts according to preconceived standards of decency. From the left canters the horseman of political correctness, committed to laundering the arts of any perceived threat to racial, sexual, or ethnic sensitivities. And from the middle trots the horseman of aesthetic correctness, demanding that the arts conform to traditional, often conventional rules of creative procedure. Besieged by every ideological camp, increasingly deprived of the funds with which to underwrite professional pursuits, it is a wonder that the serious artist has continued to survive at all in such a hostile climate. Tocqueville, of course, who has been much quoted this session, predicted this, as he predicted so much else about American culture. "I do not believe," he said, "that it is a necessary effect of democratic institutions to diminish the number of those who cultivate the fine arts." He wrote this in a famous passage from Democracy in America. "But these causes exert a powerful influence on the manner in which these arts are cultivated. In aristocracies, a few great pictures are produced. In democratic countries, a vast number of insignificant ones." To his mind, in short, future artistic standards would be determined not by the intrinsic quality of the art so much as by the extrinsic size of the audience. The fact that mass culture would absorb high art would henceforth worry many social commentators. But these fears intensified during the cultural wars of the 50s, when such crusading highbrows as Dwight MacDonald typically began protesting the power of what he called mass cult and mid-cult to debase and overshadow high cult. And you'll notice even the terms that MacDonald uses to indict popular culture seem to have been influenced by the language of the mass periodical that he sometimes worked with for Time magazine. Raging in such periodicals as Partisan Review and Commentary, these culture wars not only planted wedges between high, middle, and popular culture, they also resulted in a serious backlash against serious art and the critical intelligence, a backlash reinforced by democratic leveling, sociological theorizing, and multicultural dogmatizing. This eventually spread to include the whole construct of European civilization and its dead white male artists and intellectuals. Someday, a cultural historian will measure the damage created by a single word, elitism, on the whole construct of American culture. It is a word that effectively treated the idea of excellence and leadership as a foreign class and race-conscious concept. The charge of elitism was hurled not only against the wealthy consumers of art, but also against their often penniless creators. You were elitist if you created works of art, and you were elitist if you bought them, thus confusing patronage with talent, economic status with artistic vision. These charges, possibly because they implied callousness towards the underprivileged and indifference to black and ethnic cultural experience, caused a major retreat, the surrender of many of the standards and values that make a serious culture possible. The attack on the right, on the arts, from the morally correct right, proved just as paralyzing as those from the left-wing myrmidons of political correctness. It began in earnest with the emasculation of the National Endowment for the Arts After controversial grants to such shock artists as Robert Mapplethorpe and Andres Serrano aroused the wrath of conservative bullies like Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina and Senator Alphonse D'Amato of New York. Mapplethorpe's ex-portfolio and Serrano's piss Christ, works for which I have no respect whatsoever, obviously were designed to épater les bourgeoisies in traditional avant-garde fashion. And if so, they accomplished their ends in a manner that must have surprised even these bohemian shock troopers. On the basis of a handful of such controversial grants, and this is where I depart from my friends on the right, conservative politicians, along with such watchdog agencies as the American Family Association, managed both to emasculate the National Endowment and to persuade Congress to impose content restrictions on all grantees in the form of a new obscenity clause that every applicant was obliged to sign. And this is where I disagree with many of the things I agree with what Ed Rothstein said yesterday, but this is an area where I depart from him. I do think this is a free speech issue, because if you take away the institutional support for artists, you are really taking away the possibility for them to express themselves freely. I'm not talking about the individual support for the artists, but the institutional support to punish the institutions for having sponsored the artists. A Supreme Court decision endorsing these content restrictions at the NEA represented an even more serious blow to free expression. And this majority position by conservative judges was later reinforced by then New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's decision to deny public funds to the Brooklyn Museum on the basis of those two exhibits of elephant horse dung that he found to be indecent. And they may very well have been indecent, but again, to punish the institution was to inhibit the possibility of further and later free expression. Not all the omens were bad. In February 2001, which is to say last year, a Supreme Court decision set some limits on the government's ability to attach strings to public money, arousing hopes that the subsidized arts might one day be free again from government interference and even government censorship. But for some reason, Attorney General Reno chose to appeal that decision, and there is no question that as a religious fundamentalist, Attorney General Ashcroft will be even more vigilant about any deviations from approved moral and religious norms. Political correctness, though just as watchful as moral correctness, also seems to be loosening its repressive stranglehold on the high arts a little, if not on the institutions where it has held the tightest grip, namely the university and the nonprofit theater. Tireless free speech agencies such as the American Civil Liberties Union and Harvey Silverglate's and Alan Kors's FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, have been monitoring the tendencies of universities to punish any violations of strict sexual, moral, and racial codes. Novels such as Philip Roth's The Human Stain and Francine Prose's The Blue Angel, not to mention J.M. Coetzee's Disgrace, which describes the same conditions in South Africa for the disease's spread, have satirized the excesses promoted by sexual harassment and date rape rules in the academy. In the theater, Jonathan Reynolds' Stonewall Jackson's House and Rebecca Gilman's Spinning into Butter have exposed the way white theater directors and academics buckle under real or imagined accusations by racial pressure groups. And a number of feminist, black, Latino, and gay writers have been permitting an element of surprise and unpredictability to enter work that has hitherto been rather rigid and ideological, and that's a big plus. Aesthetic correctness brings us to ourselves, a number of us anyway, including me, and it presents a somewhat naughtier question because the condition it reflects has a much longer history. Over centuries, the critic and the artist, in the guise of academic and professional, or theorist and practitioner, have confronted each other with suspicion and anger over how the art should be conducted. Posterity, which is what we always have to appeal to as artists, may ultimately vindicate the presumed deviations of the artist in his own time or her own time, but it is the critic's judgment that most influences contemporary taste. And just as the critic tells people what to think about a work of art, so the theorists tell the artists how to create, often by imposing rules on creative expression. In the past, such orthodox agencies as the Académie Française, demanding strict conformity to the unities, forced Corneille in Le Cid to squeeze the events of 40 years into a single day. Today, the same custodial mentality, still guarding the gates like Switzers before the Vatican, often rebuke high art for drawing on the often vibrant, if sometimes vulgar, energies of popular culture, thus driving the wedge between them even deeper. Moral correctness, political correctness, and aesthetic correctness all derive from the same censorial Puritan spirit. Like a replay of parent and child, the corrector demands the right to punish the artist's incorrigible impulse to misbehave. It is in the theater, where the press wields the greatest power, that one finds the greatest distance between artist and critic. Reviewers and theater people have about as much affinity for each other as the mongoose and the snake, and there's little doubt who has the biggest lump in his throat. Indeed, if the American theater is in trouble today, it is not because it lacks fine creative people in every area of activity. Actually, to my mind, the number of gifted artists in the theater today and the level of seriousness is relatively high compared with past ages. The theater is in trouble partly because it lacks an informed, committed, and yes, I would say sympathetic criticism. I'm not talking about boosterism or cheerleading. I'm speaking of the kind of intelligent support that F.R. Leavis once gave to D.H. Lawrence, that Edmund Wilson gave to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and George Jean Nathan gave to Eugene O'Neill. The intelligent mentoring that helped these writers to learn and to grow. What we have instead today is something I have come to call Himalaya criticism, after Danny Kaye's famous rejoinder when he was asked how he liked the Himalayas. He said, "Loved him, hated her." In other words, thumbs up, thumbs down. Judgments based on ignorance, arrogance, and relentless opinionating. There is a fourth horseman laying siege to the arts these days, perhaps the most ominous of all, and its name is fiscal correctness. We live in a time when our children are no longer being exposed to genuine art or encouraged to practice it and try it themselves. There was a period right after the Russians beat us into space with Sputnik, when the federal government made an unprecedented effort both to improve our educational system and to advance our artistic institutions. Virtually every culture center in this country dates from that period, along with most of the resident theaters, symphony orchestras, opera companies, and dance companies. Since then, however, the cuts in funding for the arts and arts education have been draconian, symbolized by the virtual disembowelment of the National Endowment for the Arts and the elimination of almost all arts programs in the public schools. It is an enduring educational principle that when the funds are low, you fire the music teacher. Under such conditions, no wonder NPR is ceasing to feature classical music. When American children think of music, they think of rock. When they think of poetry, they think of hip-hop. When they think of art, they think of graffiti. We are no longer developing audiences for the serious arts. That is our government's contribution to the culture. 50 years ago, the majority of participants in the first Partisan Review symposium on the subject of our country and our culture seemed to call for an embrace of American values and an end to alienation. The result was the absorption of many artists and intellectuals into the mainstream of American life. We did not sufficiently realize then, I think, any more than now. That to paraphrase Flaubert, it was possible to be regular in our family life and love of country while being ferocious, demanding, and nonconformist in our love of art. The September 11th attacks are certain to reinforce this 50-year-old endorsement and reemphasize the need for consensus. Although we should beware lest we allow our patriotism to limit our civil liberties, most of us feel the need for national unity in the face of serious external threats to our existence. We should recognize, however, the cultural price that we have paid, are paying, and will continue to pay for this embrace of our country and our culture. It is the same price being exacted by America's well-intentioned commitment to diversity, namely, the prospect of a pluralistic culture without high art, a generous and democratic society in which everything is given equal opportunity except the greatest achievements of the Western world. Thank you very much for your time.
Drama critic and educator Robert Brustein speaking on What Has Happened to the Arts at this spring's conference sponsored by the Partisan Review on Our Country, Our Culture, the Changing Role of Intellectuals, Artists, and Scientists in America, 1952-2002. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from Tina Tobey and Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Have a good evening.
This is WBUR.